Let's kick this thing off. Okay, as I said, our next speaker is Dr. Peter Sandman, creator of the Risk Equals Hazard Plus Outrage formula for risk communication. Dr. Sandman is one of the preeminent risk communications speakers and consultants in the United States today. He has also worked extensively in Europe, Australia, and elsewhere. His unique and effective approach to risk managing risk controversies has made him much demand for all sorts of reputation management as well. Dr. Sandman has helped his clients through a wide range of public controversies that threaten corporate or government reputation, from oil spills to labor management battles, from vaccine autism scares to siting of hazardous waste facilities. In terms of the first popularized by Dr. Sandman, these are usually situations where the hazard is low, the outrage is high, and the core task is outrage management. Please welcome Dr. Peter Sandman.
Thank you. And thank you for that introduction, which covers at least the first 10 minutes or so of what I was hoping to say. So you gave me a good start. I'm going to try and cover as much as I can of two topics. First, the basics of risk communication, including some of the sort of core strategies for talking to upset publics, talking to, you know, whether it's a large group of people at a public meeting or whether it's one angry person on the telephone. You know, how do you do empathic communication in high stress interactions? So, that's the first thing. And I promise to get through that, both the basics of risk communication and then some of the applications for talking empathically to people who are upset. If I have time, and that'll depend partly on how many questions and partly on how verbose I am, if I have time toward the end, I want to run you through the six main strategies of what I call outrage management. By then, you'll know what outrage management is and where it fits into risk communication. Anything I don't get to, it's on the slides, and I assume you will have access to the slides. And it's in enormous detail on my website. My goal in life is to get everything I know onto my website so that I could retire. I achieved that goal and retired, and then came back out of retirement to try to help with the COVID-19 pandemic. So if you want to get access to the website, which is www.psandman.com, it's totally non-commercial. Nobody's going to ask you to register or buy anything. And it's got enormously more information than any normal person could possibly want on how to do risk communication. So with that beginning, let me start with the traditional definition of risk, a definition that I suspect most of you have seen somewhere in your training. It's very straightforward. It's two things: a multiplication of magnitude, that is, how bad is it when it happens, times probability, how likely is it to happen. And you get your best measure of how bad it is and your best measure of how likely it is. You multiply that by each other and you come up with what most technical people mean by risk. Back in the 1980s, I started screwing around with that definition. Can I have the next slide, please? Zach, are you there? Ah, there we go. I started fooling around with that definition and I said, all right, let's take the word risk and divide it into two components. Let's take, next slide please, Zach. Let's take what normal people think of as risk and relabel it as hazard. That's what the experts mean by risk. And then I just lost the slides. Am I still on? Oh, there we go.
Yeah, you're still here.
Okay, my computer is doing weird things. Let's take the other half of risk, the half that the experts ignore, and Zach, I'll take the next slide, and call that outrage. Zach? There we go. That word is not a great word. I've done consultation now on five continents, and I've tried to think of the right word for outrage in dozens of different languages, and I don't even know the right word in English. Part of what I mean by outrage is fear. Part of it is anger. Part of it is kind of the wimpy cousin of fear, concern. Misery is in there too, certainly in this pandemic. A lot of what I'm calling outrage isn't fear only, and isn't anger mostly. A lot of it is misery. So that's in there too. Anything that upsets you is part of what I mean by outrage. So back in the 80s, I took these two words, hazard and outrage, and connected them with the formula that sent my children to college. Next slide, please. And that formula is risk is equal to hazard plus outrage. Now, technical people hate this plus sign, and I suspect some of you in the audience are already unhappy with this plus sign. They hate it partly because, how dare you add outrage to our nice, pristine technical concept of risk, but they also hate it because of the plus sign. And whenever I give a speech to an audience of engineers, I can count on somebody murmuring and, almost audibly, that's what happens when you let a humanities major write a formula. So I devised an alternative version of this formula that technical people like better. Next slide, please. Risk is a function of hazard plus outrage. If you don't know what that means, that's hazard plus outrage in their code. Risk is a function of hazard and outrage. Now, I want to take a couple of minutes to talk about this formula and what it means. And I want to start by pointing out to you the extremely low correlation between hazard and outrage. It is approximately 0.2. Accounting, if you know some statistics, you multiply a correlation to get the percentage of variance accounted for, a glorious 4% of the variance. Or, and here it is without numbers, if you know a risk is dangerous, that tells you almost nothing about whether it's upsetting. If you know a risk is upsetting, that tells you almost nothing about whether it's dangerous. On the other hand, the correlation between outrage and perceived hazard is quite high. It's about 0.7, accounting for roughly half the variance. So we have a very close relationship between whether you're upset and whether you think you're endangered, but a very weak relationship between whether you're upset and whether you're actually endangered. Now, let's look at that high correlation between outrage and hazard perception, and let's ask ourselves the direction of the causality. That is, are people upset because they think it's dangerous, or do people think it's dangerous because they're upset? Now, that's an important question. If you want to manage something, you have to understand its causal structure. You don't want to be in the embarrassing position of trying to manage an effect in order to influence a cause. That's not good engineering, it's not good science, and it's not good risk communication either. So there's been a lot of research on that. And the bottom line answer is there are arrows in both directions. There's a causal relationship in both directions. But outrage is mostly cause, and hazard perception is mostly effect, okay? And that's very important. For the most part, people think a risk is dangerous because they're upset. It is not mostly true that they're upset because they think it's dangerous. And that implies that if you want to manage the system, you have to manage the outrage. Outrage is the engine of hazard perception. Hazard perception is not the engine of outrage, and actual hazard isn't the engine of anything. Now, I hasten to add that hazard's important. I'm not saying, don't bother about the hazard. I mean, most of the people in the room or in the group are in the business of managing pesticide hazard. And I'm not telling you that's not worth doing. I'm telling you it has very little, virtually no relationship between the other two variables. No impact on hazard perception, no impact on outrage. So we have these two closely related variables, outrage and hazard perception, and off in a corner we have actual hazard. And I want to emphasize that outrage is a major cause of hazard perception, but it's not the same thing as hazard perception. It's a real thing in its own right. It's about emotion, about affect. It's about being upset, being angry, being frightened, being miserable. And then that, you know, those emotional factors are a major cause of whether you think the situation is dangerous. But they're not the same thing as whether you think the situation is dangerous. All right, so with that basis, understanding that hazard and outrage are independent variables that have very little a relationship with each other, I now want to graph hazard against outrage. Next slide, please. And we're gonna fill in this graph and deduce from this graph the three paradigms of risk communication. And we're gonna start in the lower right-hand corner. Next slide, please. And these are the risks that are high in hazard and low in outrage. Very likely to get people endangered, very likely to do harm, but not very likely to get people upset. Okay, the hazard exceeds the outrage. People are less upset than they ought to be. I call this paradigm precaution advocacy. The essence of this paradigm is warning people. The core message is watch out. And this is the first kind of risk communication. And as you might suspect, next slide, the very essence of precaution advocacy is to try to increase the outrage. Now, you're not trying to increase the outrage for the fun of it. You're trying to increase the outrage because you understand the causal structure you're working in. You're trying to increase the outrage in order to increase the perceived hazard, in order to get people to take precautions, or to tolerate precautions if they're the ones you're taking, or to demand precautions if you're an activist trying to get more precautions to be part of the regulatory regime. So whether you're an activist or you're a regulator or you're the source of the risk itself, the essence of precaution advocacy is to increase the outrage in order to increase the hazard perception, in order to increase the likelihood that people will take or demand or tolerate precautions. Precaution advocacy has a whole lot of components, a lot of sort of basic strategies, most of which are grounded in the fact that you're talking to people who are apathetic. Low outrage equals apathy. And when people are apathetic, you have to keep your messages short because their attention span is short. You have to make it interesting in order to get their attention at all. You have to repeat a lot because they're not paying very good attention. You want to appeal to something, appeal to emotions, appeal to needs, find something. You can't just educate them in precaution advocacy because they're not interested enough in getting educated. So if you want more on precaution advocacy or on anything I'm covering, go to my website and you can get details on how to do precaution advocacy. In essence, how to scare people. You know, and if you have in the back of your mind an idea that I want them to take precautions, but I don't want to scare them, you're handicapping yourself. You're tying one hand behind your back. Because the very essence of getting people to take precautions is, in my judgment, to increase their outrage. Okay, on the other side of the graph, high outrage, low hazard. Thank you, Zach. We have outrage management. Now we've got people who are more upset than the degree of hazard justifies. The outrage exceeds the hazard. That's the venue of outrage management. And just as the core of the paradigm in precaution advocacy is watch out, the core of the paradigm in outrage management is calm down. Now, the message isn't calm down because calm down isn't a calming message. All too often when you say calm down, it sounds as if you're saying, calm down, you hysterical fool, don't panic. And those are messages that are more offensive than they are useful. When people are upset, telling them to calm down is bloody unlikely to calm them down. But the, you know, so the message isn't calm down, but indeed the paradigm is calm down. Next slide, please. What you're trying to do in outrage management is to reduce the outrage. You can picture, if you like, a bisect of this graph that starts in the origin and moves up, moves rightward and upward at the same time, that bisects the graph, so that, you know, along that bisect, outrage and hazard are equal. That is, people are as upset as the hazard justifies. And the goal in these two paradigms is to get to that bisect. So you're trying to increase the outrage and precaution advocacy to make it commensurate with the hazard. You're trying to decrease the outrage in outrage management, again, to make it commensurate with the hazard. And I'm going to return shortly to some of the strategies of outrage management. And if I get that far, I'll talk about things like staking out the middle, acknowledging your prior misbehavior, acknowledging your current problems, sharing control, being accountable, giving away the credit. These are all core strategies of outrage management. They are totally useless in precaution advocacy. And if you get nothing else out of this presentation, I hope you come away with the idea that you need more than one toolkit to do good risk communication. The precaution advocacy toolkit and the outrage management toolkit are completely different toolkits. And I need to add that neither toolkit puts a lot of emphasis on explaining data. And I suspect a lot of you have experienced the low effectiveness of explaining data in outrage management. You're talking to a group of people or an individual, but let's make it a group. And there you are in front of the room and you're explaining why this pesticide is not really very dangerous, way less dangerous than the pest that the pesticide is trying to manage. And you have all the data in the world about the low hazard of the pesticide. And as soon as people have a chance, or maybe even before you want to give them a chance to talk, someone stands up in the back of the room and says, "You're lying. We're all going to die of leukemia." And there's tumultuous applause. You've been there, right? And you ask yourself, what does it take to applaud the idea that you're going to die of leukemia? And the answer is outrage. When people are outraged enough, they would rather die of leukemia than believe you're not the Antichrist. Or at least they would rather believe they're going to die of leukemia than cut you any slack and decide that that pesticides aren't dangerous after all. And under those circumstances, you're going to have a very hard time convincing them that they're not going to die of leukemia. They want to die of leukemia, or at least they want to think they're going to die of leukemia. And you have to address why they find it, more congenial to think that the pesticides are killing them than to think that the pesticides are not killing them. You have to address that motivational issue before you can educate them about the hazard of pesticides. I think most of you kind of have learned that on the job. And risk communication is a way of explaining why that's true and what you can do about it. But before I return to outrage management, let me finish this chart. Let's go to the next slide, please. Up in the upper right-hand corner, we have the third paradigm. Now we're talking about high hazard, high outrage. People are upset and they're right to be upset. And this is, of course, the venue of crisis communication. If the paradigm in outrage management is calm down, the paradigm in precaution advocacy is watch out, the paradigm in crisis communication is we'll get through this together. Next slide, please. And you'll notice there's no arrow. because you're on the bisect already. The outrage is high enough. There's no need to make it higher. It would be dishonorable to try to make it lower. People are right to be upset, and trying to get them less upset, it's dishonest and it's unwise, because how upset they are is going to be their motive for taking precautions. And you want them in a crisis. You want them to take precautions. So there's no arrow, but there's still a lot of communicating to be done. You want to help them choose precautions, choose the right ones rather than the wrong ones. You want to help them bear the situation and bear the outrage itself. So there's still a lot of risk communication to be done. Next slide, please. This is the last slide of this sequence of on this graph. Down in the lower left-hand corner, I have found no circle worth drawing. Low hazard, low outrage. People are calm about a trivial risk. That is not a venue where you need risk communication. What would you say to them? Congratulations on your apathy. You're absolutely right. This is trivial. So I've never found that to be a profit center as a risk communication consultant. On the other hand, it's worth mentioning that this is just a snapshot. And, if you anticipate that there's going to be high hazard, or there's going to be high outrage, or there's going to be both, then even though you're now in the lower left-hand corner, you might want to do some preliminary precaution advocacy or preliminary outrage management or pre-crisis communication. Certainly, experts, epidemiologists and virologists now wish they had done a whole lot of pre-crisis communication a year ago about the pandemic that was about to strike. So there is something to be done in the lower left-hand corner if you don't think you're going to stay in the lower left-hand corner. Let me summarize where we are so far. Next slide. These are the three paradigms of risk communication. If outrage is low and hazard is high, you're in the venue of precaution advocacy, watch out. If outrage is high and hazard is low, you're in the venue of outrage management, calm down. If they're both high, you're in the venue of crisis communication, we'll get through this together. And again, what's most important is that these are three separate toolkits with three very different sets of strategies in order to meet your risk communication goal. Your goal being to get in precaution advocacy and outrage management, your goal is to get the outrage commensurate with the hazard. In crisis communication, your goal is to help people get through a very difficult situation. Next slide, please. Okay. Very quickly, I just wanted to give you a little bit of exposure to the key components of outrage. This, again, outrage is what most people mean by risk. So if a risk is voluntary, if I'm in control, if I trust the sources, if they're being responsive to my concerns, if it's a familiar risk and what could go wrong is not very memorable, if it's only dangerous, not evil, if I don't feel a lot of dread, if it's chronic rather than catastrophic, all of those things are going to make me think it's no big deal, no matter how serious the hazard is. On the other hand, if it's on the right-hand side of this chart, if it's involuntary and controlled by others and the sources are lying to me and they're not listening to me and the risk is unfamiliar and the bad outcome is memorable and it's evil as well as dangerous and I dread the outcome and it's catastrophic, all of those things are going to make me think it's dangerous, even if the hazard is quite low. So these are the determinants of outrage, and that makes them also the determinants of hazard perception. This is work, by the way, not done by me. Most of what I've said up to now is largely my work, but these components of what I call outrage, they used to be considered components of hazard perception. And I'm trying to make it clear that it's not just misperceiving the hazard. There's something real going on here that I call outrage. But this is work done by Paul Slovic and others back in the 1970s and 1980s. This is a short list. There are other factors, at least 20 of them, that have been identified in the literature. The big three, more often than not, are control, trust, and responsiveness, the second, third, and fourth in the chart. But some of these are, you know, some of the 20, any one of the 20 might be the big one in a particular controversy that you're in. So it's always worthwhile to figure out if you're trying to manage the outrage down because you think people are too upset, or if you're trying to manage the outrage up because you think people aren't upset enough. It's always worthwhile to figure out which components of outrage are available to you, which components would it be most useful to get higher or lower, depending on what your goal is. And obviously this is a game that can be played in either direction. So, you may be trying to manage the outrage down while somebody else is trying to manage it up. That would be largely true if you're a regulator and you're dealing with activists or upset neighbors. On the other hand, if you're dealing with companies, you may be trying to manage the outrage up and the company's trying to manage it down. So it's the same causal structure no matter which side of it your assessment of the hazard makes you be on. Okay, one more thing I should say. We can measure all of these factors, but we don't have a regression equation. So we don't actually have a single formula that tells us how high the outrage is. We can say how high the voluntariness is and how high the control is and how high the trust is. But we don't know what numbers to stick in front of each of those factors in order to get a regression equation. Someday, maybe. But we're not there. And I have to tell you, we're no closer than we were 20 years ago. So I'm beginning to doubt that we'll ever have a regression equation. If you think about pesticide risk in terms of these factors, obviously, let's assume that somebody is spraying pesticides on, somewhere in my environment, and I didn't ask them to do it. So it's coerced, not voluntary. It's under their control, not my control. They may not be trustworthy, or at least I may not judge them to be trustworthy. I can't trust the science. I can't trust the government, or at least I feel I can't. I've called you 9 times and you've never answered my call, and there goes the responsiveness. It's a very unfamiliar risk. You're spraying dimethyl meatloaf, a complicated chemical compound I've never heard of. I have a vivid image of people in moon suits spraying dangerous chemicals, in the early part of a movie, and in the later part of a movie, they're dropping like flies. You thought you were killing the flies, and the people are dropping like flies. So I have a vivid image of what can go wrong when pesticides are mishandled. I may well think that this is not just a matter of dangerous, this is a matter of evil. Lots of people think pesticides are evil. The word poison, which is a morally loaded word, is often used in talking about pesticide controversies. I dread what you're going to do to my immune system. And it's obviously catastrophic because you didn't spray yesterday, you sprayed this morning, or you sent me a notice that you're going to spray next Tuesday. And that's a brand new catastrophe in my risk environment. The point, obviously, is whether the hazard is high or low. The outrage for a lot of people, the outrage of pesticide risk is high. Next slide, please. Let me say a little bit about the audiences you're talking to. These were supposed to be 4 concentric circles, but I haven't quite figured out how to put concentric circles on a slide. So they came out looking like eggs. But that doesn't change the theory any. In the middle circle, we have fanatics. These are people who care more about the issue than anything else. You know, there's their job, their family, and you. Or maybe this is their job. You know, you are, after all, a pesticide fanatic, and you know, somebody who has decided to make this their life's work, and you know, it's giving their life meaning to fight with you. Those are the fanatics. Fanatics are on both sides. Surrounding the fanatics are the attentives. They care a whole lot less than the fanatics, and they're paying a whole lot less attention, but they still care more than most people. It's one of their big issues. It's just not distorting their lives. Surrounding the attentives are the browsers. They're following the issue in the media, but they're following dozens of the issues in the media. And this is just one of them. It's not their hobby. It's not their hobby horse. It's not the thing that they are paying most attention to. And surrounding the browsers are the inattentives, who are ignoring the issue entirely. You know, they have better things to do with their time. This is a snapshot. So there are arrows, and people can move in, and they can move out again. They can become more and more interested in an issue. They can become less and less interested in an issue. Now, in managing a controversy, this chart is very important. There are basically three strategies for managing a controversy. The first strategy is support mobilization, okay? And that's aimed at your side's fanatics and attentives, the people who are very interested in the issue and are on your side. They think pesticides are great. They think pests are bad and pesticides are good. They're your loyal allies, or they're you. You know, and mobilizing support from the people who are fervently on your side is one way to manage a controversy. Okay. The second way to manage a controversy is public relations. That's aimed at browsers, people who are barely paying attention. And the goal of public relations is to get them casually, half-heartedly on your side instead of casually, half-heartedly against you. Very different from support mobilization. You can do both, but you have to divide your time somehow. And public relations is obviously enormously important if there's going to be an election, because browsers vote. But it's way less important if there's a non-elective controversy, because browsers are barely paying attention. They're reading about it. They're watching it on TV. But they're not going to go to any meetings. They're not going to write a letter to the editor. They're not going to call you up on the phone and harass you for allowing pesticides to happen in their environment. So the browsers may not matter to you, and public relations may not matter to you. The third kind controversy management is the kind I'm going to be focusing on. That's outrage management, and that's aimed at the other side's attentives, okay? You're missing the inattentives. Everything misses the inattentives. You're missing the browsers. You're not really interested in the browsers. And you can't change the mind of the fanatics. I mean, the fanatics are gonna be the fanatics. It's bloody unlikely that a fanatic changes sides. It happens. You know, conversions on the road to Damascus happen, but they're very rare. And for the most part, your audience is anti-pesticide attentives, people who are uncomfortable with pesticides, worried about pesticides, but it's not the issue that dominates their lives. And they're open to persuasion. They're not necessarily going to be anti-pesticide attentives forever, whereas the fanatics may well be anti-pesticide fanatics forever. But you don't interact with the attentives, you interact mostly with the fanatics. So the essence of outrage management, it seems to me, is interacting with fanatics while attentives watch. And your goal is to get the attentives less interested. Okay, if you can turn the attentives into browsers, that's great. Then they're out of your hair. Now you don't get the fanatics, I'm sorry, you don't get the attentives less interested by convincing them that the fanatics are wrong. You get the attentives less interested by convincing them that you are paying attention to the fanatics, that you're listening to the fanatics, that you're taking the objections of the fanatics on board. And if the attentives feel that you are attentive enough to the fanatics, then they can sort of let the issue go and they can become browsers. And that's your goal, is to get the attentives out of your hair by convincing them that the fanatics are getting your ear, that you're listening to the fanatics, that you're taking the fanatics seriously, so the attentives can afford to let the issue go. I think that vision of what your goal is, I think is very important. Okay, we're about done with the basics of risk communication. And the next thing I want to do is talk about empathic communication in high stress situations. Let me stop for a minute and ask Wendy, have any questions arisen if that you want to raise? Because this is a good time for questions before I go into the next big topic.
I do not see any questions, sir.
Is that a good sign or a bad sign?
I'm not sure. I think there will be.
Okay. Well, if questions come, feel free to interrupt me with them. If not, I'll keep on going. What time does the break start again?
Where are we looking? 10:20.
10:20. You mean 11? The break should be at 11:20. Is that right?
No, I'm so confused. We're oh yes.
I started.
I'm sorry.
I started at 10:30.
I need to flip the page.
So yes. I should break it at
11:30.
Okay. So we're making good time. We have a good 20 minutes before the break. So let me have the next slide then, Zach. And we'll be on this slide for a while. We may be on this slide between now and the break. So Zach, if you have to go to the bathroom, it's a good time. And this is the basics of empathic communication in high stress situations. That is, how do you talk to people who are upset? Okay. And the first of the basics is to listen. Or as I have often said to clients, let them vent. My clients often think venting is useless, that it's a waste of time, but it's not a waste of time. Nobody is capable of listening to you when they are desperate to vent their outrage. Nothing useful can happen in a dialogue, in the sense of dialogue, until people have had an opportunity to vent. So whether it's one-on-one in a phone call or one-on-one out on the street, or whether it's in a public meeting, whatever the venue is, the first step in dealing with upset people is to let them vent. And that's hard to do. It's hard to want to do. We want to explain why they're wrong. we want to answer them before we've listened to them. And one of the very most difficult parts of outrage management is to listen long enough. And I have a standard for long enough. Long enough is until they demand that you talk. And there's a kind of a seesaw operating here. If you listen, and if you keep listening, and if you keep listening, and you keep listening, and you keep listening, eventually people start wondering what you think and what is your response to all of this. And they will begin to want to hear from you. And until that happens, you're not done listening. Even after that happens, you're not done listening. They'll want to listen to you for a little while and then they'll want to vent some more. Venting happens in stages. But I wouldn't even try to speak until an outraged audience starts asking me to speak. So you listen and you keep on listening until they demand that you talk. Now it's active listening. I don't mean you check your emails while they're venting. And most of us have some skill at active listening. You murmur uh-huh from time to time. You nod your head. You take notes if that's appropriate. But you know, so that you in a variety of ways you communicate that you are in fact listening. This is critical to the structure of meetings. The typical structure of a meeting, you know, your PowerPoint occupies the first 3 hours of the meeting, and you know, in the last half hour when people are exhausted and the babysitter is sending texts saying, "When are you coming home?" finally you get to the Q&A. And that is the normal structure of meetings. If you can turn that around and start with the Q&A, if you can start, remember, these are, you know, in precaution advocacy, you have to do all the talking because they have nothing they want to say. In outrage management, they have a lot they want to say. So if you start with them, if you start by saying, you know, let's hear what people have to say, what concerns you have, what concerns you brought to this meeting, and you stand up there at a flip chart or a whiteboard and you write down, you know, the concerns, and you don't respond to them, you just write them down. Or maybe you respond very, very briefly just to say, you know, yeah, we're going to get to that, or yeah, that's going to be in Susan's presentation, or gee, we hadn't planned to talk about that, but we can work it in. You know, so you kind of cue how you're going to deal with various concerns, but you don't actually deal with them until people have had a chance to get them all on the list. And if you can do that, you will notice that people calm down shockingly quickly. Just the opportunity to tell you what their concern is and get it on the list. They already feel way better than they felt at the start of the meeting. And you know, why would you want to wait? If you do it in the normal way, you can sometimes see people rehearsing their question. You're giving your PowerPoint and, you know, they're hardly listening. They're focusing on what they're going to say when you finally give them a chance to talk. So it's way better to let them talk first. All right, so step one is to listen. Step two is to echo. And again, I hasten to stress, step two is less important than stress one. So don't be in a hurry to echo. Keep listening until they start demanding to hear from you. And then when it's finally your turn to talk, the most important thing you do is you show them you heard what they had to say. Now that has to be provisional. The last thing you want to do is claim, "I know how you feel." The answer to "I know how you feel" is always "no, you don't." And it's always a very angry "no, you don't." So you don't want to claim that, but you do want to show that you have in fact heard them. So you do it provisionally. You say things like, "Let me see if I understand what you're telling me. If I've heard you right, it seems to me there are three main concerns that I'm hearing." And then you list them. You know, and if it's a meeting, you say things like, "A lot of people in the room are very worried about X. A lot of people are very angry that we did Y. A lot of people are demanding Z." So it can be the things they're worried about, or the things they're demanding, or the things that they're angry about. But you echo what you've heard. You echo it provisionally. "Let me see if I understand." So, you know, and you give them a chance to say, "No, you got X right, but you got Y wrong." They get a chance to correct the record. But the essence of step one and two is, in step one, they get to tell you what a jerk they think you are. In step two, you get to tell them what a jerk they think you are. In neither step do you get to tell them what a jerk you think they are. That is, the ways in which you think they are wrong, the ways in which you think they are being stupid or ignorant or idiotic or unwise or unscientific or whatever the word that, you know, the synonym for jerk that's uppermost in your mind. You may eventually get to where some version of that has to be said, right? I mean, you know, you're not going to get through an entire interaction without eventually getting to the things you think they're wrong about. But that comes very late in the game. Early on, first you listen, and then you tell them the things you think they are right about, or at least you echo the things that you've heard them say, even if you think they're wrong. save the fact that you think they're wrong and focus on demonstrating that you at least heard it. Okay, then comes step three, which is to ask questions. Now, you have to be careful about asking questions. You don't want to make those questions too intrusive. There are some strategies that I'll get to in a minute for making the questions less intrusive. But the most important thing about asking questions is to have your heart in the right place. If your questions are genuinely to understand better how they feel or what they experienced, you're going to be fine. If the goal of your question is to show off or to embarrass them or to one-up them, to prove that you know more than they know, if it's masquerading as a question, but it's really a demonstration of your expertise, they're gonna figure that out. They're gonna smell that out, and the question is gonna do harm rather than good. So empathic questions are questions to which you really want to know the answer. They are therefore almost never framed in the negative. Aren't you really saying, or don't you really think, is almost never an empathic question. That negative formulation, aren't you really, is a tip-off that you're telling them how to feel rather than actually trying to understand how they feel. You know, and the classic shrinky question, how do you feel, turns out to be a pretty decent question. But sometimes you have to deflect it. Sometimes even asking people how they feel is too intrusive. You don't have permission, or you feel like you don't have permission to ask how they feel. So you can deflect it. Instead of saying, are you worried about X? You might say, do you think a lot of people are worried about X? And that gives them a chance to answer, you know, to tell about their worries without owning the worry. I may get to more on deflection later. You can deflect from them to you. You can deflect to a third party. I was talking to someone last week and what she was worried about, that's a deflection. You can deflect to a vague some people, you know, a lot of people I think are angry because we did X. You can deflect to the abstract. There's probably reason for people to be worried about X. So there are a variety of ways to ask questions without asking questions too aggressively. And framing the question as a statement is one way. You know, I wonder if there are people in the room who are worried about X is less intrusive. Deflecting it is yet another way. Find your own level. You don't want to deflect more than you have to, but find your own level that's necessary in order to find that middle ground between being oblivious to how they feel and being intrusive into claiming a right to know emotional facts about them that you don't have a right to know. So I think that's all I want to say about number three. Number four is find things to agree with and points to add. That's the yes and strategy. There are always things you can agree with. Whatever the conflict is, there are always things they said that you can agree with and that you can add to. You know, I really resonated with what you said when you said X. It reminded me of something I experienced years ago. Or another example of your point that you may know about is Y. You can always find things to not just echo and not just ask questions about, but to agree with and add to. The problem isn't that you can't find them. The problem is that we're not usually looking for them. Whenever outraged people are venting, what they're venting is a combination of three kinds of content. Some of what they're saying is things that are true. Okay. You know, real truths. Some of what they're saying is things that are exaggerated. You know, there's a germ of truth in there, but they're exaggerating. And you know, the actual claim they're making is false, despite the germ of truth that underlies it. And some of what they're saying is crap. They're just wrong. And almost always when people are outraged, they're going to give you a mix of truth and exaggeration and crap. And if you're a normal human being, when it's finally your turn to talk, the thing you're going to want to respond to is the crap. Okay? You ignore their valid concerns, their valid objections. You ignore the germ of truth in their exaggerations. You take the most stupid, most false things they've said, and you talk about those. You know, you rebut the crap. And that's normal. That's human. But it's bad risk communication. It's particularly bad outrage management. So what I'm asking you to do is ignore the crap for a while. You're probably going to have to rebut the crap eventually, because, you know, there are things they believe that are false. And, you know, part of what you owe them as a regulator and as a truth teller is to correct their errors. So you're going to have to get to the crap eventually, but don't front load the crap rebuttal, because the crap rebuttal is the hardest stuff for them to hear. And you haven't heard you haven't earned the right for it to be heard yet. Ignore the crap rebuttal wait for the crap rebuttal and focus on agreeing with stuff that you can agree with. And if there's nothing substantive you can agree with, there's almost always process points that you can agree with. If they're dead wrong about the hazard, they are still very likely to be right about the outrage. So they're very likely to be right about, yeah, we should have answered your letter. Or yeah, we really screwed up in not telling people what pesticides we were going to be using. Whatever. We really should have told you about the content of the MSDS instead of waiting for you to find it online and raise hell with us about it. There are always, or almost always, outrage points that they're right about, even if there's nothing hazard related that they're right about. So find things to agree with. And then the last thing, because I think it's almost time for the break. The last point I want to make before the break is find things to voice reservations about. If number four is yes and, number five is yes but. It's not just but, you know, you're not just saying you're wrong, you know, you're saying yes, but, you know, you have a point, but, okay. And some of that is correcting exaggerations. You remember I said some of what they're saying is true, some of it's crap, but some of it has a germ of truth. So in four, you're addressing the stuff that's true. In five, you're addressing the stuff that's exaggerated, that has a germ of truth, and you're validating the germ of truth more than you're invalidating the exaggeration, but you're doing some of each, okay? I think this is very important, and it's a sort of a good point to end the first half of the presentation on, that, you know, when you're talking to people who are upset, and they believe X, and you're trying to convince them to believe Y, you know, what you have to do is take them on a journey from X to Y. You can't just say, why, you idiot, you know, X is stupid. You ought to believe Y. That is not going to help. So you have to take them on a journey from the X position they're in to the Y position you would like them to end up in. The way you start that journey is by voicing everything you can think of that validates X, that validates the position they already have. And if you can't validate X in terms of hazard, you can validate X in terms of process. You can say, yeah, X is reasonable. X is common sense. X used to be true before we changed the formula for the pesticides. X used to be what we thought before we did more research. X is common sense. X is what I used to believe before I came to work for this agency and they sent me to re-education camp. All of those are ways of saying it's not stupid to believe X. And you know, you want to find the soundest case you can make why it's not stupid to believe X and start there. And then you can begin to take them on a journey from X to Y. And you know, that journey may include data. It may include anecdotes. It may include emotional content. It may include all kinds of content. You know, if you can think through how you got, if you used to believe X, how you got from X to Y, you know, if you didn't start out loving pesticides, that's an acquired taste. You may try to remember how you got there. And that'll help you figure out how to take them on the journey. But the first step in taking them on the journey for sure is to explain the ways in which they're right. And then only in the context of that, begin to voice some reservations, begin to talk about the ways in which they're wrong. Wendy, I want to stop there, take a question if there is one, and then take the break.
Okie dokie. Basically, we're getting some chit-chat back and forth about experiences that we've all encountered, but not any direct questions for you, because okay. You're so thorough.
Okay, I'm willing to take that as a good sign.
And, it is a good sign.
Let's take the break, and if questions occur to people during the break, we can start with them before we move on.
Fabulous. Thank you. All right, everybody, lunchtime.